So we have a combination this week of two things, which is, I don't know if it's a good combination or a bad combination. One is because this was the first class after Pesach, I actually had a lot of time to prepare, which is always a bad thing. And the second part is that it's Parshiot Tazri and Mitzorah, which means that there's absolutely nothing good to say about. So I have to say, you have the new book on Vayikra or you don't?
I do.
Because I have things there.
I have
there on it. Okay. For your son, we'll find something. Let's begin with source number one. Ve'deber Hashem Moshe ve'el Aaron lemer. God speaks to Moshe and Aaron, saying, Adam ki yeh ba'or b'saro se'eto sapachad o baheret. I don't know how to translate any of those things. The English here says, when a man shall have in the skin of his flesh a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot. Okay, now I guess that's all clear. Vayoba orbisil aneget tzara'at, and is on the skin of his flesh like the disease of leprosy. So, of course, I'm sure you know that the use of the word leprosy over here is really done by for convenience more than anything else, but to a very great extent. For the most part, Chazal have insisted that we're talking about something which is of a spiritual dynamic and not necessarily of a physical dynamic. Vuva ela Aaron HaKohen, and this would be pretty good evidence, because you don't bring it to the family doctor, rather it says that you bring it to Aaron the Kohen, who is a spiritual doctor. He is perhaps a metaphysician and not a physician. I'm sure his mother was happy anyway. My son, the metaphysician. Okay, anyway. Vuva el Aaron HaKohen, o el achad mi banav HaKohanim, or to one of the other Kohanim, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of Pasuk Dalet, it says, v'hiskira Kohen et anega shivat yamim. And the sufferer will be shut off for 7 days. There are degrees of being shut off. And this is something which I believe that we have discussed in the past. I mean, what you have is, and again, this is the way to think about the world, because we don't tend to think this way. Think about the context of when this is taught. It's taught in the Midbar. And in the Midbar, you have in the center of the camp, you have the Mishkan, right? You have the Machaneh. You have the what would be called the Machane Levia, right, Leviim, and then you have finally the regular, bless you, the regular camp, which means the first level of Tum'ah, when we talk about impurity, really would mean a distance from the center, distance from the Mishkan or from the Beit HaMikdash. It means the person who's Tameh, what does it mean to be Tameh today? Right? When we speak about Tum'ah, what does Tum'ah mean? So Tum'ah is basically irrelevant to us today, for very simple, except for probably the possible concept of Nida, which is actually a hybrid of two different types of laws. But the concept of Tuma today is irrelevant. I know for a Kohen it's relevant because a Kohen can't become Tameh, can't go into a cemetery. But the reason why the laws of Tuma are irrelevant to us is very simply because we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. If we had a Beit HaMikdash, then suddenly the laws of Tuma and Tahara, right, spiritual impurity, impurity, would suddenly become much more relevant for us. In source number two, you have to, from the office, ask them to print out more for you. You have an extra one? In source number two, the Targum, and you'll see later why I bring this Targum, the Targum actually translates the word nega, tzara'at, as sagiro, which means to close off. So it's interesting that it understands the idea of tzara'at is to be closed off. Now, the law of tzara'at is even more than regular tumah, because regular tumah means that you can't go into the Beit HaMikdash or the Mishkan, but you are within the general society. The law of Tzara'at is even more extreme, because not only can't you go into the Mikdash, you're closed off, which means this is a more extreme sense of Tuma than just about any other example of Tum'ah would be. So therefore, over here, when the Targum does insist that the trans, that it's not just, it's not even a literal translation. It's the meaning, that's a better word here. The meaning of tzarat is sagirus, to close them off, because that is functionally what tzarat is. Tzarat is when somebody is closed off completely. Now, I'm going to read in source number 3. Cherem. Cherem is interesting because cherem, we treat somebody as if they have tzarat. We decide that because of a person's behavior or thoughts or actions, that now that they are to be separated from us. There are no more. If you want to ask from the office or for another, for them to print out another copy. I'm sorry. I'm going to read a pasuk in Iyov, which has nothing to do with anything. I mean, it will afterwards, which is why I'm going to read it. The pasuk says, it's in chapter 25 of Iyov. Iyov, for those of you who don't know, is the book of Job. J-O-B is Job, it's not Job, right? And it says, La'asot l'ruach mishkal, umayim tikein bamida. This is one of those things that God actually does. He makes a weight. I don't like the word weight, because it really doesn't mean weight. La'asot l'ruach mishkal. What does the word mishkal mean? So you can say it means weight. But how did they weigh things in the olden days? With a scale. So therefore, a scale means something which is completely balanced. So it says, La'asot the ruach mishkal, that God created the wind in a way where there is complete balance in the world. That's what this is trying to express. There's a world of balance. So over here, weight, it means that if, only if you can visualize, you know, the old types of weights, that is really a balance. Umayim tikein b'mida, and God creates water by measure, which means that God's creation is one of absolutely perfect balance. Now, as I said, this verse has nothing to do with anything except that the Midrash, which we're going to spend all our time with today, the Midrash on the ideas of Tazria and Mitzora, or more so Mitzora, is going to focus on this verse. This is going to be the starting point in terms of a long exposition. But before we get to the Midrash itself, I just want to consider a second. When we hear the word Ruach, right? La'asot l'ruach mishkal. God creates ruach and balance. What does the word ruach mean? So, when we want to know what something means, what do? We look in the Chumash, and we look for various usages of it. And that will take us through sources 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, till I basically gave up once I got to the 8th chapter of Bereishit. But again, the first use of the word, which is always significant, that's a tradition that we have from the Vilna Gaon and others, that if you want to know what something means, you look for its very first usage. The first usage of the word ruach is actually in the very second pasuk in the Torah. Bereishit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz. Very second verse is in source number 4. V'haaretz hayta tohu v'vohu v'choshech al pnei tahom. The world was empty and void, and darkness was hovering above, and the Spirit of God, Ruach Elokim. Well, here Ruach is modifying Elokim. It's Ruach Elokim, Spirit of God, which means our very first use of the word Ruach is certainly trying to articulate something which I would call spiritual stuff. Okay? I try to bring over here different usages of it, and not just, it's not every use that I brought here. Source number 5 actually doesn't have the word ruach. It's Vayitzar Hashem Elokim et Adam, afar min adama, vayipach batav nishmat chayim, vayadam lenefesh chaya. That's when God forms man out of the dust of the earth, and God breathes within the man the spirit of life, and man becomes a nefesh chaya. What would you call a nefesh chaya? A living being, a vibrant being, a being of life. The Targum over here, which is very famous, which you all know, in source number 6, the Targum translates that verse, Ubra Hashem l'kimyat Adam, right, God created man, or formed man, Afra min ha'ara, right, dust of the earth, V'nat pach ba'apohe, nishmat da'dichai, God breathes into man the soul of life, V'hava ba'adam l'ruach mimalala, and man then became a person who had the spirit, but over here the last word is what's interesting, it's the spirit of speech. which means over speech, the ability to speak. That man has the ability to speak. Now, just in case anybody here doesn't not necessarily remember or has no idea at all what it is that I'm trying to do, so let me remind you of a couple things. One, the first thing that we see over here is the Spirit used in the sense of the Spirit of God. Secondly, we see that God breathes into man something, and that becomes man's soul. Right now, man becomes this ability, this being with a soul. I can speak of man as being some type of a microcosm of God, which, of course, is a very dangerous concept, because then some of us will get deluded into thinking that we're actually divine. But on the other hand, we need to understand that there is the Spirit of the divine within us, and this comes because God breathes within to us something. Now, this something that God breathes into us is, we can call it, a lack of a better term, a soul. Those of you who are students of Jewish mysticism will know that there's actually a bunch of different terms used for the soul. There's five different levels of the soul. And one of them is ruach. One of them is, in fact, spirit. I'm not being technical right now, even though we will have a nice passage from the Zohar soon. I'm not being technical right now in terms of the different levels of the soul, and I'm saying things in a general, very general sense. But we have this ruach Elohim, and then we have man becoming this ruach mamalala, which basically, if I had to define what is it that makes man in the image of God, it is our ability to speak. Again, notice something. Throughout Bereshit, God's creation is not by flexing anthropomorphic muscles. Did you like that sentence or no? How does God create according to the narrative in Bereshit? Again, it could have said God took, right, and formed, and so on. We have God's hand. Again, what's anthropomorphism? Giving God human terms, human qualities. Now, when we say God speaks, are we giving God a human quality, or is speech God giving man a divine quality? Okay? Again, just to understand what I think is beneath the surface over here, because when it speaks of man being created and God blows into him the soul of life, and therefore God animates man, brings him to life by giving him something spiritual. So what is the result? The result is that's why this Targum Onkelos is so interesting. What's the result? Man becomes a speaking being, which means that really, according to the Targum, is this image of God which we possess. Okay, this ability to speak. Now, God creates by speech. God said, let there be light. God says, let, meaning all of creation is by God's speech, which therefore should give you some indication of the power of speech.
Continue. So you're saying that the image of man, his ability to speak, is a godly part of him?
Yes. And that's why. That's
the soul?
I said that's the manifestation of it, which means that's what makes us different from the rest of the animal kingdom. Our ability to take ideas and put them into letters, into words, into sentences, into paragraphs, into books, which no one buys or reads.
Is that why the reason that
That I can't tell you. Rabbi Nachman actually said, this is also something we learned years ago, but Rabbi Nachman actually said the opposite, that Vayidom Aharon, the highest level, is when man controls his speech.
Control the speech.
And again, the ability to speak and then to control it. Yeah, which means if you can't speak and you control it is one thing, but if you can speak and you hold back your words, then it's even on a higher level. Okay. Source number 7, which is interesting, immediately after the sin, Vayishmu et kol Hashem Elokim etalech lepegan l'ruach hayom. So you go and figure out what the word ruach means in that context. The spirit of the day, the wind of the day, is that something spiritual? Is that something physical? Is that something divine? And of course the tragedy, one of the great tragedies, this is probably the first great tragedy in the history of the world, v'yichabeh adam v'ishto, man and his wife hid from God, which we've been doing ever since. Hiding from God is really the result of the sin. Source number 8, when God speaks about the flood, he says, I'm going to bring the flood. All animals that have some kind of spirit of life within them. Source 9, Vayizkor Elokim et Noach v'et kol ha'chayev v'et kol behemah asher itov b'teva yaver Elokim ruach al ha'aretz v'yishok omayim. And then God sends a wind throughout the world and the water settles. Basically, how many different uses of the word ruach have we just now seen? We've seen ruach in terms of wind. We've seen ruach in terms of, let's say, something which is divine. We've seen ruach in terms of the divine coming down into man to be able to speak. And we've seen ruach this as wind, I said that in the beginning. And we saw this ruach in the Garden of Eden when man feels they have to hide, and that's the one we don't necessarily know what it means. Now, all that should get you ready for source number 10. Source number 10 starts off and says, Adam ki ye ba'or b'sarosa eto sabachat v'heret. That's the verse that we started with. A person who has tzara'at. What are we going to call tzara'at, just to confuse us all? Leprosy. Person who has leprosy, it says, Ahu dichtiv, that's the hehi dalid, Ahu dichtiv, that's the verse that it says in Eov, the one that we just now quoted that I said has nothing to do with anything, which now the Medrash decides does have something to do with our topic. La'asot l'ruach mishkal, Umayim tikein bimida. So it quotes our verse about balance. Now, in my Kleinman edition, Medrash Rabbah, which is from Art Scroll, it introduces this Midrash and says that it's about to give three interpretations. The Midrash begins its exposition of Tzara'at, it actually says Tzara'as, by citing a verse from Job, presenting several interpretations, the last of which is relevant to tzara'at, which means this commentary could not figure out what we're about to read, and saying, okay, this has nothing to do with anything. Now, the reason why I find that a little bit more difficult is because it would not have introduced it by saying a person has tzara'at, that's what it refers to in this verse, and then say, oh, no, it's only the third interpretation. I will agree. Third interpretation perhaps is easiest to understand, and I've been spending the last 9-10 days contemplating what exactly this Midrash means and how it's really related to our topic, and even if we won't be completely satisfied at the end today, maybe we will be, depends how lucky we get, but at least we'll see direction. I even posted as my Facebook status question, what is the connection here between these three things? And nobody had anything remotely relevant or important to say. Amar Rav Huna taught, Bishlosha mekomot, in three places, Yotzta ruach shelo b'mishkal. There are three places that we had, I'm going to call it right now, obvious, blatant, lack of balance. Again, just what did the verse say? God creates things with balance. One of the things with balance is the wind. So there's three places that the wind has a lack of balance. Now, again, when we read this verse, ruach, we immediately ask ourselves, which ruach is this referring to? So the first source of the year in the Midrash, at first glance, is referring to ruach in terms of simply the wind. The way your average Israeli secular child would answer if you ask him, what does ruach mean? And they'll say, it's the wind. So it says, Amar v'hunu b'shalosha mikomot yatzta ruach shelo b'mishkal, v'kvar hayala lachriva ta'olam, and there was enough there to destroy the world. V'elu hein, and these are the three cases. Ha'achad b'yimei Iyov, v'achad b'yimei Yonah, v'achad b'yimei Eliyahu. One was during the time of Eov, Job, one was during the time of Yonah, and one was during the time of Eliyahu. So therefore the question that I posed is, what exactly is the connection between Eov, Yonah, and Eliyahu? Which is an obvious question that all of us should be asking ourselves. And now it proves its point. It says, B'yimei Eliyahu, B'yimei Eov, sorry, it says, V'nei ruach gdola ba'ar me'eva midbar. During the time of Eov, this big wind comes. Now, the thing which is the connection here is that this is the only three times in Tanakh that it uses the phrase ruach gedola, because we're just told that the ruach is in balance, and over here, yet sometimes there's a ruach gedola. Presumably, ruach gedola is where there's not going to be balance. Doesn't use the word ruach gedola. I think azah. I think it uses there, but not gedola. V'nei ruach gdola ba'am e'ever midbar, b'yimei yona shenemar, v'ashem hitil ruach gdola l'yom. And by Yon it says that God sent a big wind onto the sea. And b'yimei Eliyahu shenemar, v'yomar, tse'evim adat v'har, v'nei Hashem over v'ruach gdola v'chazak mefarei karim. By the time of Eliyahu, God says, stand on the mountain, and this large wind that can break mountains came out. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, b'Rabbi Shalom, he oto shel Iyov, he oto shel Yana, he oto shel Eliyahu. That all three of these winds were the same wind. Right? So we now, bless you, we now realize that we have a theory of conservation of wind, and it's the same wind which came out because it's the same ruach dola, it's the same lack of balance that existed in all three cases. Bishvil oto habayit haita oto shel Iyov, bishvil oto sfina haita oto shel Yona, bishvil oto ma'ase haita oto shel Eliyahu. That they're all the same, but the biggest one of all of them is the one of Eliyahu, but they're all the same, which is now we realize that we're completely confused and we have no idea what this midrash is telling us. And let's go back to the point which our midrash, or commentary on the midrash, said so eloquently, this has nothing to do with Tzara'at. And why do they come to the conclusion it's nothing to do with Tzara'at? Because... Well, it's not here. It doesn't say anything about leprosy. So not saying anything about leprosy leads us to the conclusion that this has, in fact, does have nothing to do with Tzara'at. Unless, of course, we're dealing with things on a more of a macro level and not on a micro level, which means... Ultimately, what is Tzara'at? And we're going to see more of this as we continue. What is Tzara'at? Tzara'at is somebody who... Well, actually, what does Chazal tell us Tzara'at comes from? It tells us that it comes from somebody who is Motzi Shemra, somebody who misuses speech. Right? That's what it's... And we'll see more about this also, where they get that from.
Because it comes also in the house.
Correct. It says first it strikes the... First strikes the person, finally ends up the house as well. But the Or is it the other way around? The idea over here is that Chazal insists that there's some kind of a literary connection between Tzara'at and Motzi Shemra. Somebody who says something which is wrong and the Tzara'at that strikes their body. Now again, that's a very interesting correlation. But again, I'm pointing out to you that the ability to speak is this idea of Ruach. And over here... And it says, no, so therefore there are going to be certain people that because of their behavior are going to have a diminished ruach. Because of the diminished ruach, they need to be isolated. They need actually to be far away from a place of holiness. When Adam and Eve sin, and by the way, there is a large degree of speech within that sin. When Adam and Eve sin, there is ruach there, but then they get sent away. They get sent away from the place which is holy. The whole idea of being sent away from the Garden of Eden is this idea of being sent chutz l'machaneh, as it was, being expelled from this place which is holy. Just to continue with the Midrash, and source number 11 is the second paragraph, which they felt was irrelevant. And then, again, we'll decide how irrelevant it really is. Dover acher, lasot the ruach mishkal, amar Rabbi Acha, afilu ruach hakodesh, sheshara al neviim, eino shara ela b'mishkal, that prophets have prophecy in balance, but yesh shen mitnabe sefer echad v'yesh nayim. Amar Rabbi Simon, shnei dvirim mitnabe ba'ar. Okay, I'm going to skip that. Amar Rabbi Shmuel, afilu divrei Torah shen amila malalotnu ela b'mida, ואלוהים במקרא משנה תלמוד הלכות ואגדה יש זוכה למקרא ויש למשנה ויש לתלמוד ויש לאגדה ויש זוכה לכולן. This is a very strange thing because it seems to say the same thing and the opposite at the same time. It says that spiritual things. Now, why are we talking about spiritual things? Because what's another translation of the word ruach? Spirit. That spiritual things are given with balance, and therefore everyone gets the same. Except then it says, but not everybody gets the same. So you say, okay, so what are we talking about? So again, I want to point out that we have over here, either we look at the world on a micro level and say, how can you say that everything is fair and everything is balanced when this individual has less or this individual has more? And then the response is that no, that spiritual things were given balanced in terms of the macro, not in terms of the micro. And that seems to be what's going on in terms of both of these sources over here. The other thing that I have to point out is that while the second source is clearly speaking about Ruach in terms of prophecy, It's real interesting to me that the subjects, in terms of the first paragraph in the Midrash, were three people who were, and I will say to what extent, were connected perhaps to the world of prophecy. Okay, Eliyahu's easy, Yonah is challenging, Eov, well, there's a conversation with God, but I'm going to come back and, as I said, have a more serious analysis about this.
If the analogy that their spirit is so strong, mm-hmm. because these are three big people, that their spirit is very strong, they're not, so they were out of balance.
Correct.
So they were able to change things.
Correct. Which means being a Navi is having too much spirit. Being a Mitzora is having too little spirit. And therefore, the reality is that these first two paragraphs dealing with the great wind or the great spirit is actually the counterbalance to the Mitzora who has too little. Which means when I look at the Mitzora and say, hold it, how is it fair that this person is isolated and alone and closed off in his world? How is this fair? It says, no, in terms of the macro, and of course it says God gives things in balance. Yes, God gives things in balance in terms of the macro, not in terms of the micro. Which means it's not, I mean, I don't know if I'm the one who has to tell you this, the world is not fair. Right? The world is not one where everything is exactly identical.
But the Nevi'im are given the extra spirit. The Mitzvah, it's his fault that it's taken away.
So let's continue. Let's continue. And that's exactly what I wanted you to think about. Let's look at the Zohar in 12 and 13, which, yeah.
It's interesting with Miriam.
Okay, we'll come to Miriam. Good. We'll look at source 12 and look at source 13. 12 immediately focuses on our Targum. Tochazi diktiv adm kia ba'od b'saro sa'et o sa'pachet o ba'heret. Hagimul zinin hachav akul ikrin negatzarat. These three different manifestations of Tarat are all called negatzarat. Haduhu diktiv, and that's what it refers to. Vayaba or b'saro le negatzarat. My negatzarat. Sagiro bekele. Have the guy locked up in prison, as it were, which means tzarat is somebody who's locked up. Okay. The Zohar, which is again literally the next page, continues and says, "Negatzarat hada atru chavrei aval tzarat kitharagumo." That is what the colleagues have pointed out, that it means according to the Targum that tzarat is somebody who's locked up. Which means again, this is a functional definition of what tzarat is, not a medical definition. Amar Yehuda, my kitharagumo sagiru de sagir velo patach. Which means it's a person who gets locked up. Continuing. Next paragraph. Amarev Allah. And still in 13. Next paragraph in 13. Amarev Alazar Tame. Why is this person Tame? Mishum de istkalat shchina mine. Why? What makes this person Tame? By the way, this now is going to be so clear for us, I hope. What makes this person Tameh? That he has a diminished sense of soul. The istakalat, which is a word, le'istalek, it moved away from him. Shechina mineh, the spirit from him, which means, again, what happens when the person is Tameh? They can't enter into the Beit HaMikdash. What is the Zohar saying? Why can't this person enter into the Beit HaMikdash? Because he has a diminished sense of Shechina. Who can go into the Beit HaMikdash? The person who has a certain sense of Shekhinah can then increase and it gets close to the Shekhinah. The person with a diminished sense of Shekhinah can't go in. Now again, I pointed out to you already from the beginning that the word Ruach is connected to the word, the idea of speech. Let's continue.
Connecting it to the soul.
Shekhinah
is part of the soul.
Mand istalek v'chavya takifa sharya v'atil zuama v'sa'iv l'mand esav v'kul begin chuvi alma. What is it that causes all of our problems in the world? Chivya is what causes it. A chivya, for those of you who don't know, is a serpent. It's the serpent is what begins to cause the problem. By the way, don't miss what it doesn't tell us. Because what it doesn't tell us is the most interesting part. Don't miss that. Who is the first being to misspeak? It's the before Chava. It's the serpent. The serpent. What kind of skin does a serpent have? Very scaly skin, which is almost looks like leprosy, which means the misspeech leading to leprosy is right there in the biblical narrative, but of course we all miss it because it's almost too obvious. Okay, but it says that it's the serpent that brings this impurity into the world. A little later on, it goes back and it talks about, it quotes the verse about the Nachash, V'ktiv v'nachash ya'aru mikol chayat ha-sadeh, Asher asa Hashem lakim v'yomer el isha, and he speaks to the woman, Elisha mamash, and one second, atar mikdasha etachid, and I'm skipping all that, where it's underlined the next line, my chuvi de lishna bisha, to begin lishna bisha, chivya is damin bein le'ila bein le'tata. It's that, it's the lashon hara, lishna bisha is lashon hara, that's what causes this tuma to come in. So I'm saying that, that these things now should really be very, very clear to us, at least on the basic level. Man is endowed with something spiritual, and that's what God gives us, that manifests in our ability to speak. We speak in a positive way, which you can now fill in the blank, what's a positive way? Is it prayer? Is it learning Torah? Is it speaking to another person, comforting another person, saying nice things to another person? Or is it using destructive words? So therefore, the destructive ability to speak is actually taking a divine gift and flipping it around and using it in a negative way. That is basically destruction. That's the opposite of Shechina, which means when it says that the person who speaks Lashon Hara ends up getting Tzarat and then gets isolated away, and what do the Zohar say is the reason for this? Because now they have a diminished capacity of Shechina. What we now realize is that there really are two different sides of the coin. We have the prophet with this incredible capacity to speak and to speak divinely. I mean, again, what is a prophet? Think about it now. The prophet is somebody who can speak divinely. Right? I'm pointing out to you that all speech is a divine gift. What should we be doing with speech? We should be speaking things which are divine. What does a prophet do? A prophet who's endowed with this incredible level of spirit actually speaks in a divine way. What does this person who has tzarat do? This person does the opposite, and this person ends up using the speech in a non-divine way, in an anti-divine way, as it were, and that person ends up getting closed up. And this person ends up getting shut up and put in prison, as it were, which is really the image that the Zohar wants you to have. Did that work more or less to understand what the Zohar wanted from us? Yes? You kids are going to quote a Zohar?
How would you get closer to Tzara'at from Tameh? Like, give me a definition of Tzara'at is Tameh.
So as I said,
it's a level of
Tameh? Yeah, ultimately, Tzara'at is a very severe level of Tuma. Somebody who's Tameh mate cannot go into the Beit HaMikdash, but can be within the community. Somebody who's Tzara'at is completely outside of the community as well, which means ultimately, Tzara'at becomes the most severe sense geographically. Right? And that's why I started that in the very beginning. If we think geographically, in terms of the Mishkan or the Mikdash in the center, the person who has Tzara'at, it's the most severe sense of Tum'ah, more so, even though we always call Tum'at Meit as the Avi Avot HaTum'ah. But in a certain sense, Tzara'at is even more so, as I'm saying, when we think in a geographical level. Okay, let's now...
What bothers me is Moshe...
I don't care what bothers you. Stop. I don't care. No. She's Moshe. Moshe had Tzara'at. At which point, we'll get back to Miriam also. Moshe has Tzara'at at which point, when he says, the Am Yisrael won't believe me. Ah, so he said Lashon Hara against Am Yisrael, and what happens? He gets Tzara'at, which means...
That was all the way at the beginning.
Why do you bother me so much? Who let you... Just wait a second. Who let her back in the class?
All the way in the beginning. That when he saw
Stop. If anybody has a chumash, it would be, was it the end of Perek Gimel, the beginning of Perek Dalet? Where is it? First he says, who am I to go to Paro?
Yeah, who is he?
Stop. The Tzara'at is in Gimel? No. Okay. In Perek Gimel, at some point God says, in Pasuk Yud Chet, Visham'u l'kolecha, they're going to listen to you. They're going to listen to you. Right? That's in Perek Gimel. God said, Moshe is saying, I can't do it, it's not me, and I'm not good. Right? Then in Perek Dalet, Vayan Moshe v'yomer, v'him lo yaminu li. God, he says, they're not going to listen to me. Right? Ki yomru lo nireh elecha Hashem. God did not reveal himself to you. So then, v'yomer Hashem, ma zeh biyadecha, v'yomer mateh. What's that in your hand? He says, it's a stick. What happens to the stick now? What does it get turned into? What does it get turned into? A serpent. Why a serpent? Because a serpent misspeaks. What happens immediately afterwards? V'yomer Hashem Moshe, shlach etcha v'chazmen, right? Grab it. And then, v'yomer Hashem lo od, right? Havino yadecha b'chekecha. Stick your hand in, v'yavad, he takes it out. V'yinei yadom, and tzarat keshalik, and his hand turns into tzarat. Moshe just now misspoke about the Jewish people. What two things appear? A serpent appears, and tzarat appear. Wow, that's pretty interesting. Okay. I don't need you to put, right?
Do people get tzarat? You know, like sotah, like, but it never happened. Do people actually get
it? Of course they get it. In the Haftorah. You have four people who have tzarat.
So it was like a common thing.
I don't know about common. What do I know about common?
It gets to be a form of
tzarat. Stop it.
Go for it.
Okay, let's continue. But thank you for bringing me there, because I wasn't going to say that unless you took me there. Now, let's contemplate our three prophets, or maybe prophets. What is there anything in common between Eliyahu, Yonah, and Iyov? And there's one thing in common that they all have, which is obvious. What's that? There's a big wind in the narrative of each of them. Okay, a big wind. The big wind is what they have in common. Okay, that's the easy answer. Let's think about all three of them in terms of their prophecy. Let's start with Iyov. Iyov in source number 14. Ish haya be'eretz utz. There was a man who lived in the land of Oz. By the way, that's the way it's translated into English, in the land of Oz. And I can absolutely assure you, that if you read through the first chapter of Iyov, you will realize where the Wizard of Oz came from. You have good angels and bad angels, good witches and bad witches. You have a big house that gets taken up by a big wind and lands on people and kills people. This is clearly the... I shouldn't tell you these things because it's the only thing you'd remember in the class today. You're not going to remember about this serpent. You're not going to remember... You're not going to remember about the leprosy. You're not going to... I wasted my time with the Zohar, right?
No.
But only if you remember something else afterwards. But I know that that was a very big mistake to point that out. Stop it already.
It's very, very... I'm here.
Can I continue?
Okay.
You want a cup of coffee?
No.
Okay.
I gave you an application.
It's source number 14. We have our introduction to Iyov. Isha ya be'eretz utz, Iyov shemo, v'ya isha hu tam v'yashar v'yirei lukim v'sor mira. That sounds very good. Iyov sounds like a very good man, very good, decent man. He's perfect, he's straight, he fears God. V'sor mira, he stays away from evil. What's missing? What's missing? Asay tov. Doing good. Eov's greatness is based upon his not doing bad. That's his greatness. He's tam, he's yashar, visur meira. By the way, let me ask you now, without knowing anything else, if this man is so perfect, and he's so good, and he's so talented, shouldn't he be on the level of a prophet? Shouldn't he have something to say? And what is the one thing that you know about Job? You know, what's the next word that you know about him? His silence. Which means Job has this inability to speak. Not an inability like we sometimes think about Moshe, but Job is somebody who remains silent. So therefore, now, again, our context, we're speaking about the great wind, right? We're thinking about the great wind, the great spirit. Here you have a man with great spirit, but for some reason, it's not translating into an ability of necessarily being able to speak. The next verse tells us, "Vayivuldu lo shiva banim v'shalosh banot." I presume he was married and there was a wife involved in this. He has 7 sons and 3 daughters, which, by the way, Kabbalistically is quite important, the number 7 and 3 having to do with the Sefirot. "Vayihi mikneu shivat elefei tzon," and then it tells us how much property he has. At the end of Pasuk Gimel, "V'yishahu gadol mikol b'nei kedem." He was the greatest man in antiquity. "V'holchu banav asu mishteh," and his children used to go and to make parties, and they would invite all the kids together to make parties. "Pasuk hei, v'yiki kifu yimei mishteh, v'yishlach iyo, v'yikadshem, v'yishkim baboker, v'ela olot mispar kulam, ki amar iyo v'ulai chat'u banai, u'berchu elokim b'livavam, kach yasa iyo v'kol yamim." They would party, but listen to how he speaks. They would party, and then he would say, maybe my kids did something wrong, and he would then have his prayers focused to take away the bad of what his children may have done, which means there's nothing proactive over here. It's only a response. Again, it's a sur meira, and there's a lack of aseh tov. The other thing is that his prayers are only focused, exclusively focused, on the children that he has and on nobody else in the world, which means Eov is, in a certain sense, Eov is a spiritual island. This greatest man in antiquity, but he stands by himself. What does he do? He prays. What does he pray? That his kids didn't mess up. Which means, wouldn't you say again, aseh tov, be proactive, educate, lead, inspire, teach. But there's none of that. It's just, it's praying or offerings according to the number of the children that he has. As I said, this is very much this attitude of sur mira. And again, after saying what I said, you read through the whole book, you realize that it is Eov's lack of speech, which is really the problem within the story. Afterwards, everyone comes and says, curse God and whatever, and he doesn't, which means why doesn't? Because he doesn't speak. Finally, if you turn the page on Pasuk Yud Tet, we have all these terrible things happen to him. V'nei ruach gedolah ba me'evar midbar v'yigar ba'abar pinot habayit v'yipol ha'na'arim v'yamutu v'mlata rak ani levadi lagidlach. The house picks up and falls, which is also interesting in terms of the story of Tzarat having to do with the house as well, and having to do with, again, this diminished sense of spirituality, and therefore the house gets affected by it. So it's interesting that the thing which comes and ends up attacking his children is the house, which means, again, I could easily say that this whole part of the Midrash has nothing at all to do with Tzarat, except that there are a couple of terms here that may be quite important in terms of Tzarat. It's, again, Eov we have as our non-profit, even, right, not non-for-profit, but non-profit, this individual who doesn't speak, he may have all of this talent, but he doesn't use it. Finally, in Perek Gimel, he does open his mouth. Takes till Perek Gimel. Acharei kein patach Eov et piu v'kalel et yomo, and he curses the day that he was born. That's finally what he does. And we end up finding Eov with a death wish. Eov saying, over here, I didn't give you the English, but I'll read it and translate. V'achrein patach Eov et piu v'kalel et yomo, he cursed his day, v'yan Eov v'yomar, he spoke and he said, Yovad yom ivaled bo, let the day perish when I was born. V'halayla amar horagever, and the night in which it was said a male child had been conceived. And then he goes on with his whole connection to darkness going on and on for a while over here. He does not sound incredibly happy, which we can understand, which means we really have two elements over here with Eov. One is his inability to speak, his lack of this great ruach, which may be within him, of being articulated or coming out. There is no speech really that takes place, and basically we end up with a death wish. Okay, so those are the elements that I want you to focus on. When we look at source 15, we contemplate Yonah. Yonah, well, if I would call Eov a non-prophet, I would call Yonah a prophet guilty of malpractice. Right? He was charged with a particular mission, and then he finds it very difficult to go and complete. If you also realize something about Yonah, Yonah is told what to say, but he won't say it. Again, that becomes very interesting, especially in terms of the comparison with Eov, source number 15, Vayhi Dvar Hashem al Yonah ben Amitai Lemor. Kum lechelin ve'ir gdola u'kralei kieltar ra'atam lefanai. Come, God says, get up and go, right? He, by the way, according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, he lives all the way up north. The port that he should have left should have been the port of Akko, because that's really pretty much where he lived. Instead, he comes all the way down to Jaffa, and apparently he wants to get a boat going in the opposite direction. One of the things we don't know is exactly where Tarshish is, but apparently it's not the direction, meaning he's supposed to go north and he goes south. So it's not just that he doesn't say what God says. When it says that he's running away, even the port that he leaves from is significant. Vayered Yafo, vayimtza unia ba'at Tarshish, vayitin schara, vayered, right, and he goes. Vahashem hitil ruach gdula elayam. And God puts this, again, here again we have our big wind. So again, here's this prophet who's supposed to speak, has a great deal of ruach, ruach ma'alala, this ability to speak, he has this great deal, but he doesn't speak. He holds it back. And what's his response to this? Vayuru malachim v'yizaku isha re'elohav, v'yatilu et hakelim ha'shabaniya, v'yonu yirad el yarkisei esfina v'yishka v'yiradam. And he goes to sleep. Which again, the spiritual impetus of Yonah is astounding. He doesn't pray. But why doesn't he pray? He can't pray to God. What's he going to say to God? Well, please save me. No. He refuses to speak to God. He refuses to speak for God. So if you hear this Ruach Gdolah which takes place, again, when you think about the Ruach Gdolah by Iyov and the Ruach Gdolah by Yonah, that was not so hard to compare these two things, because over here we have two non-prophets or two people who are not really using the spiritual abilities which they seem to have. And both of them can't pray, and both of them can't speak to others. Right? Go get up and pray. But he doesn't. He doesn't. He can't pray. He can't. So that itself is interesting. When does he pray? Yeah. When he goes to hell. Which is basically, that's the understanding of the whale. And the reason I say that is... Of course, of course, of course. Now he gets closed up. And I'm calling you out from the very deep depths of... really, the word Sheol often has a connotation of hell, which means he is as shut up from anything spiritual as possible, and he reaches out. It's also interesting later on where he write, where it says in Pasuk Chet, let my prayer go all the way to your holy temple, which means here he is as distanced from the holy temple as you can be, right, in the depths of the water, closed in, right, in prison within this whale, and he's saying, but let my prayers nonetheless break through the walls of the whale, go up to the sea, go up to dry land, go across the land, and go back to where the holy temple is, and let my prayers be accepted. So over here, obviously, even though I would say that till this point, Yonah also has a death wish. Why do I say he has a death wish? Because this, think about it, this incredible storm comes, the boat is sinking, everybody else is praying, right? All the atheists are praying, right? There's no atheist in a sinking ship, right? Is that what they say? And over here, he is the only one who, by the way, think about how calm he is. He's able to fall asleep. But one second, aren't you jealous of him? Can you imagine somebody, the world is collapsing, and he says, okay, I'm going to take a nap now. I'm saying, that is something which is unbelievable. It's unbelievable that he is able, and why would I say this? Very simple, he wants to die. He wants to die. So now again, when I told you this parallel between Eov, who then says, cursed is the day that I was born, cursed is the fact that I live it all, he won't curse God. Eov all the way through won't curse God, which everyone else tells him to. He may as well just curse God already. He won't do that, but he will curse his existence. I mean, that's what Eov is willing to do. Yonah will get into a fight with God, and he will say bad things to God later on. We're not going to consider that today. But it's interesting, again, this image of the distance from the holy, this inability to speak. And therefore, I'm just going to say it now very, very clearly. This first part of the Midrash also has to do with Mitzarah. It's the counterbalance of the Mitzarah. It's looking at the world on a macro level. But let's move over to Eliyahu first. Eliyahu is really probably the most mysterious of our prophets. The more you study Eliyahu, the more you realize you don't know anything. He just shows up one day, where he comes from. They don't even know who he is, where he's from. Is he man? Is he an angel? And then he disappears one day. He just doesn't even die. He goes back into heaven. You even of those who suggest maybe he never was a man, he was just always an angel who came from above. But we consider him to have been somebody who was a human being, born of flesh and blood, and so on and so forth. We're not going to consider other things right now. But Elio, and his name itself is fascinating. Eliyahu, which means you have a combination of Yudke Vavke and Elohim, right? My God is Yudke Vavke, Eliyahu, like the name of God. Is right there in terms of who his essence is. It was a tough time in the world. All the other prophets are gone. All the other prophets were killed. He finally has a showdown. Now, Eliyahu is a prophet. Eliyahu does speak. Eliyahu is the opposite of them. He speaks and he's not afraid to speak and he confronts the people who need to hear it. There's only one problem with Eliyahu, and the problem is it doesn't work. Which means he has this huge, huge showdown, right, with the Nevi'ei HaBaal, with the prophets of the Baal. Not only does he speak, he shows that all the other prophets, remember, he pour water on the altars and so on, and then he makes the fire come down from heaven, and he puts on this great, great show, and what happens later? Ezebel comes and says, I'm going to kill you, which means he prophesizes, but it doesn't work, which means Eov is the opposite of the others. Eliyahu is the opposite of the others. He's somebody who is a prophet, has incredible prophetic ability, and then he runs away.
And he cursed the people. He made them suffer.
He tries to improve the people who are sinning.
He's a bad father.
Look at source 16. He runs away. V'olach b'midbar derech yom v'yavo v'yeshiv tachet rotem echad v'yishalet nafsho lamut. And he says, I want to die. Okay, so now we see with Eliyahu, you also have the death wish right away. So now, if I ask you what the connection is, all three, you have Ruach G'dolah, and all three also, you now realize, have a death wish. Rakat Hashem kach nafshi ki lo tova nochi mi'avotai v'yishkav v'yishan. So he also is able to fall asleep. V'neze malach nogea bo. So that's interesting, because the word Tzarat is nega tzarat. Nogea bo, v'amelo kum echol, but here's the opposite. He's touched by an angel, not touched by tzarat. Because again, Eliyahu is the one who is the prophet. He is the one who does speech. So instead of having nega tzarat, he is nogea from an angel. V'yabet v'nei mereshotov ugot ritzafim, and food is provided for him magically. V'yashav malach Hashem shenit v'yigabo again. V'yomer kum echol, get up and eat, because you got a long way to go. He then travels pasachet v'yakom v'yachav v'yishteh v'yelech b'koach ha'achila hi arba'im yom v'arba'im laila. Does that remind you of anything? Ad har Elokim chorev, till he gets to the mountain of God b'chorev, which means over here, it's almost like we're going back in time now. There was once again another very lonely, very, very capable prophet, and that was Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu can also speak to the people, and to what extent it has an impact, we can question. But it's interesting now that Eliyahu's role as a replacement for Moshe now becomes very, very clear. The 40 days and 40 nights, and then going back to this place of Har Elokim Chorev. Again, it can't get clearer than that. V'yosham el ma'ara v'yalon shem, and then he rests in a cave. V'nei dvar Hashem ilav, and God speaks to him. V'yomer lo malach apo Eliyahu, what are you doing here? V'yomer kano kaneti l'Hashem, I had zealousness for God. They have broken the covenant, they have broken your altars, they killed your prophets, and I'm the only prophet left. I'm pleading of you, please take my life as well. So over here you have a man who had prophesied, but what's the one problem? He's saying it hasn't had any impact. It hasn't worked at all. Stand in front of the mountain, and this huge wind comes. right? And which could break, right? Lefnei Hashem, lo baruach Hashem, v'acharuach rash, lo barash Hashem. But this big, great wind will come, but God is not the wind, and then this great noise or thunder, God is not the noise, v'acharash ish, lo ba'esh Hashem, God is not the fire, v'achar ish kol demama daka. But God is ultimately within the still, silent voice, which is very interesting, because after speaking about great spirit and great ruach and great ability, ultimately it's this spirit that God breathes within us, which creates within us a very soft voice, which of course needs to be listened to. When it's not listened to, that's when the problems occur. By the way, at the very end of this paragraph, we don't get anywhere, because I am the end of source 16, Pasuk Yudalid, Vayoma Kano Kaneti Lashem Elokai Tzva. He says the same thing again. Kiesvu Britcha, Bnei Yisrael Mizbuchecha Rasu, Bet Neviyacha Rogu Bechara, Vivatarini Levadi, Vekvakshayu, Et Nafshi Lakachta. In the very end, he says, I'm the only one left, and please take me. Which means Eliyahu, we find over here, also with a death wish. Now, in a sense, Eliyahu is actually the inverse of our others. Really the inverse of Yonah and of Eov, because Elio does speak. All three of them want to die. He does speak, but they don't listen to him, and that obviously causes him a great deal of spiritual pain. One thing which I will point out is at the very end of the Elio story, I mean, almost the very last scene of the story, he's about to go up, takes off his mantle, gives it to Elisha, he's about to go up in his fiery chariot. Source 17, Vayikav Ramva Elio Amar Elisha, Sha'alma Eselach, Biterem Elakach Mi'imach. Elio says to Elisha, what can I do for you before I'm taken from you? Vayomer Elisha, Vayina Pishnaim Beruchacha Eli. Give me double of your spirit. Give me double of your ability to be a prophet. That's what Elisha asked for. And we notice, again, the word Ruach over here, the spirit, is quite interesting. The reason why it's interesting is the reason it's interesting by itself, it's interesting. Let's just put it that way. Elio is this man of great spirit and it doesn't work, and now his follower will ask for twice as much. This is also the same as the very end of the book of Yonah. At the very end of the book of Yonah, the resolution is, and this I got from an essay from Rabbi Soloveitchik, the resolution in Eov, the resolution in Eov is when Eov prays for others. I mean, till now, it was all for himself. At the very end of the book, look at source 18. V'Hashem shav et shvut Eov pit palalo ba'ad re'ehu. That God then returns to him when he prays for others, which means when Eov finally opens up his mouth, not in a negative way, but finally opens his mouth in a positive way and prays for his others, for the friends, not just for his children, because they may have done something wrong, but he prays for his friends. At that point, Vayosif Hashem et kol asher le'Eov le'mishneh, then God gives back to Eov double of everything he had before, which means double the possessions and double the flock and double the wealth and so on and so forth. Eov, and then everyone lives happily ever after in the book of Eov, which, again, in reality, if you lose, especially Yom HaShoah coming up, you lose children, but get new children, then you live happily ever after. It's not necessarily the way that it works, which is why there is an opinion in Chazal that Eov l'mashal haya, that Eov is a parable and not necessarily meant to be taken as literal historical book. But at the end of the book, again, the interesting thing here is the double that takes place, just like the double at the very end of the story. And both of, again, Eliyahu has his voice. It just doesn't work, which makes him very frustrated. Eov finds his voice and then gets double. Yonah is actually the most difficult out of all of them. At the end of the book, Yonah, if you get to Perek Dalet, he still has a death wish at the end. He sits in a little house, a sukkah, outside of the city, which is, again, sitting in a house outside of the city is... Do I need to spell this out for you? Sitting in a little house outside of the city is really this image of the Mitzara, who's sitting and isolated from everybody else, which means he's acting like a Mitzara. He's not in the city. He's outside of the city. He's in his little hut outside. And at the very end, what does he say? At the very end, he says, and again, God sends another wind over here. God sends a wind and it hits him on the head and he passes out and he says, V'yishalet nafsho lamut, v'yamatov moti michayai, which means our reluctant prophet Yonah still has a death wish at the very end of the book. I do want to point out something which I think is very interesting about Yonah in terms of where his spiritual capacity came from. And that's in the Yerushalmi in source number 20. Again, it's always interesting. First of all, Alav Amakumon Yafa, Lemdu Rabbi Yochanan, Imu Me Asher, V'Aviv Mi Zvulun, V'Yarkito Al Tzidon. Yerachit Emen Mi Tzidon Haya, V'Ktiv V'Yard Mi Yafo. He should have left from up north. He should have gotten. He lived in Zvulun, which is towards the north. Why did he come all the way down? That's part of his running away. So that's the point I made earlier, is actually here in the Yerushalmi. Skip a couple of words, where it's bolded. Amar Rav Yonah. So this is one of the many, many, many times that we find in the Midrash that the person who's speaking has the same name as the person who he's speaking about. The rabbi Yonah in the Yerushalmi is speaking about the biblical character Yonah, so he's going to explain the inner workings of Yonah. Amar Rabbi Yonah, Yonah ben Amitai me ole regalim haya. He had traveled from the north. He's actually also explaining why he leaves from Yafo. He travels from the north and he's ole le regal. So where does he come? He comes to Yerushalayim. Which holiday? Sukkot. Benichnas the Simchat Beit HaShoeva. He went into the Simchat Beit HaShoeva where there was so much spirit. Again, it's going into the temple and feeling God's presence. Visharat alav Ruach HaKodesh. And at that moment, the Ruach HaKodesh descended upon him. Which it seems to imply that he really should not have been a Navi. I'm sorry for saying that, but that's what it seems to sound like. He seems to sound like, here's a man who really didn't have the capacity for being a prophet under normal circumstances, but he gets filled up momentarily in a moment of ecstasy. He gets filled up with some extra spirit, and he has this vision from God telling him to go and do something. He tries to run away from the Spirit of God. Again, many have pointed out he tries to leave the land of Israel because there's no prophecy outside the land of Israel, at least theoretically, but you know, God is still talking to him. God is still communicating with him. But over here we have once again our reluctant prophet who perhaps maybe never should have been a prophet. He has a death wish from the beginning. He has a death wish in the end. There's two more things I'm going to say quickly because we have to finish up already. One is, there's a whole other level to the story of Nineveh, the city that he goes to, which we're not going to get into, that would have been interesting. So I'm just going to tell you that it's here. But there is an insistence in source number 21, which is completely ahistorical, transcends any concept that you can possibly consider. And it tells us, why does the king of Nineveh so quickly tell everybody that they need to do tshuva? Is because he knows from experience that when God says something, he means it. And this Pirkei de Belezer insists that the king of Nineveh was actually Paro 400 years later. That Paro survives, he makes it to Nineveh, he becomes the king of Nineveh. He's quite old, by the way, at this point. And when the prophet comes and says, listen, you better change your ways, Paro, king of Nineveh, takes this. Now, whether this is meant to be in a literal sense or meant to understand this, yeah? Yeah.
How could someone like that, who is an angel, have a death wish? Because it's so human.
Right. So I agree that the argument that he was an angel is a difficult one. The reason why we would say it is because his appearance is just, he shows up one day and then he disappears one day. So that's really more of the problem. But correct.
He. So he's supposed to introduce the Mashiach when he comes.
Correct. He has a death wish because it must be very, very frustrating to have so much spiritual capacity, to see so much, be able to say so much, be a conduit for God, and it doesn't work. Which means, correct, the idea that Eliyahu comes back to usher in the Messianic age is that, okay, God's response is, okay, didn't work then, but it's going to work. I mean, there's going to be a time that you're going to complete your mission. You didn't complete it then, it's not your fault. They weren't ready for it, but you're going to come back and you're going to do it. So again, that is certainly an interesting aspect in terms of Eliyahu. So as I said, you have this whole Paro part, and stick Paro away. By the way, at the very end of that source, the Pirkei de Elazar in source 21, it's exactly what you just now mentioned. At the very last three lines, which I underlined in 21, the Ein Yisrael Osin Tshuva Ad Shivo Eliyahu Anavi. Shenemar Hinei Enochi Shaleich Lachem Et Eliyahu Anavi. Lefnei Ba Yom HaGadol Vano Ravi Shiv Leiv Avot Al Banim V'Leiv Banim Al Avotam. Baruch Ata Hashem Harotze B'Tshuva. So it's a fascinating end. It says that, and that's the last verse in Prophets, by the way, right? Almost. That in the end of Malachi, that at the very end of the day, Eliyahu will come back and he will cause this great unification of the generations and are going to cause there to be no, shall we say, generation gap. People will be of one mind and that will bring about this massive tshuva. People will return back to their roots and back to Torah, back to God, and that will usher in the Messianic age. One more thing which was under the surface of everything that I said. In source number 22, the Gemara tells us, V'tanya, arba chashuvim kemet. There are four people, even though they're quite alive, they're considered as if they're dead. Who are they? An ani mitzara v'sumo misha'in lo banim. Somebody who is poor, somebody who has leprosy, somebody who's blind, and somebody who has no children. How do we know the mitzara? Dichtiv, al natihi kemet. Don't let her be like someone who's dead. And that's what Marian mentioned a good half an hour ago. This episode with Miriam. Now the truth is, the episode of Miriam ties everything in together that we've talked about today. Miriam speaks about Moshe. Source 23. But to bear Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe. Miriam and Aaron speak lashon hara about their brother Moshe. Aladota isha kushita shelakach, isha kushit lakach. Vayomru, what do they say? Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem? Does only Moshe have prophecy? Over here in this narrative, we actually have a combination between a couple of different elements. We have a combination between lashon hara, prophecy, tzara'at, and being locked up. I mean, all of the elements we talked about are right over here. And ultimately, the answer is that not all prophets are equal. But by the way, that's an important thing. Because remember, we saw that midrash that says, no, that God gives the ruach in an equal way. Yeah, it's in an equal way in terms of the macro. There are some people with less, some people with more. Which is why the whole discussion of the prophecy had everything to do with the issue of the Mitzorah. The Mitzorah is somebody who's very, very distant from the Beit HaMikdash. Where does Yonah get his prophetic ability from? When he enters into the Beit HaMikdash, which means, again, is that a lack of balance? It's certainly a lack of balance. What happens to the Mitzorah? The Mitzorah is somebody then, the leper, is somebody then who loses, as the Zohar said, his Ruach. What happens to Yonah? He gets extra Ruach. He gets extra spirit. But what's the problem with extra spirit is that that's not such an easy thing to deal with, which means prophecy is not always the easiest thing. Having this great ability doesn't really necessarily translate and the all of Happily Ever After, which means we look at Eliyahu having this incredible ability, and then you think, wow, and he gave twice of that to Elisha? You know, it's a little scary for Elisha afterwards. Then you think about Eov, who's this incredibly talented person, but there comes responsibility with that. And that's the part which becomes a little bit frightening. Over here, Miriam and Aaron speak Lashon Hara. And what do they say? Is only Moshe a prophet? God also spoke to us. What's God's response to Miriam, which you don't have in front of you here? What's God's response? No, it's not true. Not all prophets are created equal. I speak to some people at night, but Moshe, I speak face to face, which means that's not true that everything is equal. It's not true that everything is balanced. Again, if there's a Moshe who has so much capability, that means there's going to be somebody else who has so little capability, which is the balance, as I keep telling you, is on a macro level and not on a micro level. What happens afterwards when she speaks? It says then in Pasuk Yud, V'anan sar me'ala o'el v'nei Miriam mitzara'at ki... Oh, no, fine, it is here, sorry. V'yom shimna... Right, if you prophesy, Hashem Arai Levit Vadeba Chaloma Deber. God comes, I come in a dream. Lo kein avdi Moshe b'kol beti ne'emanu. Moshe is trustworthy in my own house. Again, a place of the Shechina. Pe'al pe'a deber bo marev lo b'chidot v'tumnat Hashem yabid. Madua lo yireitim l'daber b'avdi Moshe. Here you have Lashon Hara about prophetic ability. What happens then? What happens then? The cloud passes by. Miriam mitzara'at kashalig, and Miriam gets tzara'at. So here you see the clear correlation between speaking lashon hara and getting leprosy. But it already was clear earlier in that example with Moshe. What does Aaron them say? Al natihi kemet. Don't let it be like somebody who's dead. And here then is the theme of death comes into it, and what happens at the end?
Shivat yamim tisager shivat yamim michutz la machaneh v'achar teyosef
So what happens? She gets closed off out of the machaneh for 7 days, and then they leave. Which I'm saying, all of the elements over here are really combined in this one narrative, but when you read this narrative by itself, you don't necessarily understand the implications in terms of all the other things that we did touch with today. So therefore, I do disagree with the comment in the Midrash over there, saying that the first one has nothing to do at all with Mitzorah. I think if one works hard enough, one will find that it has everything to do with Mitzorah. Have a good week. And not Aaron. Aaron is a Teflon man. Aaron gets away with everything. Life isn't fair.
No, Aaron is by himself.
Except he does lose a couple kids along the way. That's true.